I believe we are Evan Jellyfish.
Hey, will you pass the salt?
Pass the salt.
We need salt over here.
It's time for Pass the Salt.
Pass the salt.
But we like to share the gospel without any backbone to it, see?
The views, opinions, and seemingly outrageous comments expressed in this program are based on the Holy Spirit leading of a man called Coach.
I gotta ask you this out there, Christian America.
It's time for Pass the Salt with a Coach, Dave Dobenmeyer.
Hey, good morning, folks. Good morning, good morning. The 27th day of December, 2019. Lord's not making another one. Let's run with patience today. The race that is set before us. What a time to be alive. What a time to be alive. A lot of great stuff. I've got Dr. Edwin Vieira on with us today, and I apologize that we had the confusion on Monday and weren't able to get him in. It was totally a mess up on my part to get him prepared to be on here, but he's with us today. It's going to be a good Friday morning. Before I get too far into it, I'm sure most of you have heard by now that Rusty Thomas's daughter, Charity, did not survive. And without going into a whole lot of details, she's been fighting some issues for a while. But this was certainly unexpected, and it happened very, very quickly. The system broke down. She had some internal bleeding from some ulcers, and not going into great detail, they weren't able to save her. And many of you know that Rusty lost his son Jeremiah just a little bit over a year ago to cancer. So this is a devastating blow to the Thomas family. And you know, Rusty's first wife, Liz, died of cancer. And then, of course, Jeremiah died, as I said, about a year ago, and now Charity. And man, that's a blow, isn't it? Trying to think if you'd even go through one of those experiences in your life is just horrific in its own sense, in its own way. So just pray that we'll have more details for you on Monday. Just pray that you continue to lift up Rusty and his family. What do you even say? I communicated with Rusty and yesterday. What do you even say? I'm sorry. Pray for you. What do you even say? So just continue to lift him up and hold him up and change Christmas the rest of your life on thinking about that one. Hey, listen, we're gonna talk today about the Second Amendment. Dr. Vieira is on here with us. We're gonna talk about the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. We're going to try to get into constitutional money, and really the love of money is the root of all evil, and how the messing with the money has given us the culture and the society in which we live in. You see baseball players making $50 million a year. So, I mean, something's out of whack here, isn't it? Something is out of whack. We also want to talk about, want you to begin to think about January 20th, excuse me, which is Martin Luther King Day. The conclusion of the show, I'm going to give you a lot of information today. At the conclusion of the show, I want you to be thinking about what our reaction is going to be in regards to January 20th, which is Martin Luther King Day, and a big rally that they're planning down in Virginia to oppose the seizing of firearms. That's really what's going on. And it seems to me that Virginia is becoming ground zero. Part of it may be a test case to see exactly what the reaction of the people are going to be. Now, historians say that, if you can get 10% of the people, 10% of the people involved, you've got a good group of people, a great group to fight. And it looks like that the numbers of 10% are maybe even being exceeded. This is the battle bull run here. We've got to stop this foolishness right here, right now. We've got Dr. Edwin, as I said, Dr. Edwin Vieira on with us. And I've known of Dr. Vieira for probably 25 years and followed his stuff and understand that he's been screaming. That's not the right word, but he's been standing up on the mountain and lifting up his voice about the Second Amendment and a well-regulated militia being necessary. Jared, if you can pull up the Second Amendment, I should have put it in our stuff here today, but for those who maybe didn't see our last show or who aren't aware of our last show, I want to get it up here so we are all on the same page to understand what the Second Amendment says. Now, remember this, before they signed the before they were able to sign the Constitution of the United States, they came up with 10 of the, called them amendments, but they were 10 agreements. Not every one of the states wanted to be part of this new federal, whatever this thing was going to be. They didn't all want to. So they put in certain restrictions to make it a little bit more palatable for them. First one being what? First Amendment, Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of a religion. Religion was really the first, maybe Dr. Vere have a better insight on that than me, but that was, every one of the states at that point had their own, Pennsylvania was Dutch, was Quakers, right? We know that. Maryland was Catholics came into Maryland. The Episcopals were in Massachusetts. So the state religion was really, really important to them. And they wanted to make sure that they're able to hold on to their state religions where they were. No national religion. Now, folks, listen, Christianity is not a national religion. I'm sorry. Christianity is a national religion. Episcopalianism is not a national religion. You with me? Being a Baptist is a denominational religion. But the religion of Christ was at the very base of what we tried to say there. But the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The right of the people to keep and bear arms. The right of the people. Now listen, I want you to try to think about this as I bring Dr. Vieira in. The difference, my friends, between power and authority. They're not the same thing. A police officer can come and he could have the power to arrest you, but not have the authority to do so. In other words, he can take off his badge and just be a citizen and put you under arrest. He has the power to do that. He could bring three or four of his buddies and they could arrest you. They have the power to do it. But the question is, do they have the authority? So one of the issues we're going to try to get into here is the authority. Who has the rightful authority in this whole idea of grabbing the guns? Can the states vote to take away what is a constitutional right? This seems to be a pretty complicated thing that I don't think is all that complicated. Dr. Vieira, come on in, my friend. And first of all, you can go ahead and correct any one of those crazy things I said at the beginning that really wasn't accurate.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you again, Coach. On this point that you made, a very important one, of the distinction between power and authority, if you look at the Second Amendment, of course, if you look at the first three words of the Constitution, you'll see that the Founding Fathers understood that the people who had authority also had to wield supreme power.
Mm-hmm.
All right? You have to have a conjunction of those two. And in our system, it is the people. We the people ordain and establish the Constitution for various purposes. We the people serve in various roles within that constitutional structure. And we the people are the ultimate arbiters and protectors of the free state concept. A Republican form of government may be a simpler way for people to understand that. That's built into the Second Amendment and actually built into the original Constitution because there are militia provisions in the original Constitution. Many people don't seem to realize that. They look at the Second Amendment about standing alone.
State meant state. State didn't mean federal government. The state meant state. Isn't that right?
Well, absolutely. You're talking about institutions which are state institutions. The Constitution talks about them as the militia of the several states. And those institutions could be called upon by Congress to perform certain functions for the government of the United States. Execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, repel invasions. But they remained institutions of the states, and they were to be composed of, as the Virginia Constitution talks about, the Virginia Constitution has an Article 13 in its Bill of Rights, now it's Article 1, Section 13, talks about a well-regulated militia being composed of the body of the people trained to arms. That's the concept, that the vast mass of people, adults basically, within the society would be trained in one way or another to perform various kinds of militia functions directed towards providing the security of a free state. And, as the Second Amendment says, and also the Virginia Constitution says, these institutions are necessary. They're not optional. They're not something that, well, we can have them or not have them depending on how we feel about it politically. They are required because of this conjunction that the Constitution is trying to maintain between authority and power.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to quote Mao Zedong of all people. I mean, he said some things that were correct, as terrible a dictator as he was, and one of them, this is probably his most famous quotation, political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Right? Ultimately, government is force, in a Amen. Practical sense, and in whose hands is that power going to be left? And the only safe repository of that power is in the hands of the people who are entitled to exercise authority. And what we've seen in this country is a separation of those two. The people always retain authority simply because of the constitutional structure, the Declaration of Independence, the foundational documents upon which the legitimacy of all government rests. But the actual power has shifted more and more into the hands of the political apparatus, mm-hmm. and not simply the ones who are elected to office. They're bad enough. But the permanent political apparatus in the bureaucracy, or as people coming to understand the terminology, the deep state or the shadow government, those people that are just there year after year after year, they never stand for election. Their activities are, to a large extent, conducted in the dark under the cloak of national secrecy or whatever terminology they like to use. And they are making the real decisions behind the scenes, and the political leaders who are elected tend to operate more or less as puppets or dummies, ventriloquist dummies for these people. So that's the direction this is going. And what Virginia shows is when they push a little bit too far, when they poke the sleeping giant a little bit too much, he comes to life once again. He's awakened by this. The Democrats won the last election in Virginia, 2019 election. We have off-year elections. They gained control of the General Assembly, Virginia's legislature. They already had control of the executive branch. The governor, the lieutenant governor, and the attorney general were all Democrats. And no sooner was the election over than they began what they call pre-filing proposed legislation dealing, among other things, but primarily for us, here, with really radical gun control. And that stirred up a hornet's nest of what are called Second Amendment sanctuary resolutions in the various counties and municipalities, towns, and so forth. I think there are over 90 of those local jurisdictions now that have enacted these resolutions, which say basically that that local jurisdictional governing body will not enforce, comply with, fund, whatever they use, different kinds of language, any unconstitutional gun control measures. And that unconstitutional adjective is important. They're not saying we won't comply with anything that comes out of Richmond that might deal with firearms, but we will not comply with the unconstitutional ones. And the governor has responded. He's kind of doubled down on that. And the latest thing that came out was he is in the budget that he's proposing, he's increasing the money that will be available for arresting, incarcerating people who violate his new gun control legislation. So, and he threatened also to call out the National Guard, all sorts of what I would call tyrannical statements coming out of Richmond from that fellow. But that's where it is now. This is the revolt of the masses against what they see as impending and really imminent tyranny coming out of the political apparatus at the state level in Richmond, Virginia. So we'll see what's going to happen because no legislation has been enacted yet. None of this new legislation has been enacted. They've simply filed some bills. We have no idea the extent to which the really extreme pieces of proposed legislation will be in some way amended or watered down or whatever to try to make some kind of a compromise, as politicians do. But the point is, this problem is not going away until it's resolved. I think until it's resolved in favor of the general population of the state.
We have a power authority issue at work here, Dr. Varian. If we go back and we think about the Civil War, and you know how all of a sudden the South began to organize and the war began. It was certainly out of the idea of the militia, the free militia of the individual states. But Dr. Vieira, the problem that we see coming together here in this argument is the Second Amendment, which is a federal amendment, a guarantee of federal government not being able to mess with our guns, and then also coming in line with the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment, which go to states' rights. The battle really that we see before us going on all across America, whether it be marijuana, whether it be illegal immigration, whether it be guns, is what really is the power of the individual states. Would you agree with that?
Well, that certainly is a fundamental question, because in some instances you have the individual states acting contrary to the federal system. You have, I mean, there's a sanctuary city, sanctuary state movement that's been going on for a while to withdraw various jurisdictions, state or local, from cooperation with the national government in the enforcement of the immigration laws. Now, that's a very negative phenomenon because the immigration laws are basically constitutional. Congress has complete authority over immigration, naturalization, importation, international commerce, people coming in and out of this country. So for the states to try to interfere with that, and they're interfering with that in favor of illegal immigration, let's be blunt about this, for the states to attempt to do that is clearly unconstitutional. Now, on the other side, if you were talking about federal gun control legislation, some of which, actually much of which exists now, is unconstitutional, then for the states to form sanctuary city-type situations there would be in favor of or promoting the federal structure and constitutional structure. What we have now in Virginia is someone at the state level attempting to assert state authority that's in violation of both the federal constitution and the state constitution. It's like the worst of all worlds in Virginia. But it's a template in the sense that, you know, they did something along this line in Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, California, New Jersey, Maryland. It's been advancing in those solidly democratic jurisdictions for many years. But this is really the first time that, in a sense, they've come completely out of the closet and said, our real goal is to take away, essentially, everything that we want to take away. Mm-hmm. Right, in Connecticut and New York, for instance, it went to registration of certain kinds of firearms. In California, they have all sorts of restrictions. But even California never proposed the kind of legislation that's being proposed now in Virginia. So I think this is a test for the Bloombergization of American politics, at least with respect to the gun control issue. The reason the Democrats, or one major reason the Democrats succeeded in gaining control of the Virginia legislature was Mr. Bloomberg from New York, through some of his front groups, poured very large amounts of money into the campaigns of selected candidates so they could tip the balance in the General Assembly, and he was successful in doing that. Also because of the apathy of a lot of voters, or the idea that a lot of voters had that we don't have to worry, really. We've always had a slight Republican majority in the assembly, and we have, of course, Donald Trump as the president, so everything's going to work out fine. We don't have to go out and vote. And so you had a low voter turnout, and on the other side, you had Bloomberg's money promoting a significant turnout for the candidates who, you know, won and are now in a position to advance this extreme radical, which is Bloomberg's agenda. I mean, really, that's where this is coming from. I don't think a lot of these candidates woke up before the election and said, oh, all of a sudden I had an epiphany here and I have to be a radical gun control proponent. They're radical money. Gun control proponents because Bloomberg gave them the money.
Yeah, money. So, Dr. Vieira, let me pause just a second because I did a show earlier, maybe it was last week, where we were talking about the Hegelian dialectic. And, folks, this is what you see at work here. If you think about guns and gun control, think about how it started, right? They wanted just to restrict guns just in this one little area. No guns in schools. And then it was no guns in churches. And so just little by little by little by little, they move you to a position that's really 6 years before, would have been untenable. You would have never fallen for that. But through the idea of compromise, they now have moved the ball so far that now they think they're close enough that they can go for the whole enchilada now, because we used to be over here, but they've moved us to here, and now they think, well, let's just go ahead and take the whole bite. So that's what's going on, the Hegelian dialectic at work. So Dr. Vieira, as we sit here on the 27th day of December, what should we, it's like I was thinking earlier, Gomer Pyle, citizens arrest, citizens arrest. Technically, Gomer, really, he had the authority, didn't he? He had the authority. There were such a thing as citizens arrest, but he didn't have the power. He couldn't execute the authority that he had. Isn't that where we're finding ourselves right now?
Well, if we go back to fundamentals here, if you look at the existence of the militia that the Constitution requires, where are these? There would be 50 of them, there'd be one in each state. Where are they? Well, they're basically moribund. You will find statutes that talk about militia. Here in Virginia, there's the Commonwealth of Virginia has a militia, and it's defined as every person from 16 to 55. It's right there in the statute. There it is. I'm older than that now, but for many years I was a member of the Virginia militia. Actually, I was a member of the Rhode Island militia. They have a similar statute. But it does nothing. It's not organized. People are not trained. They're not armed. They're not equipped. They don't even realize that they are subject to that kind of duty as a constitutional or statutory requirement. So we don't have those institutions. That's the major problem, I think. That's why I've always promoted dealing with the Second Amendment, focusing on the first 13 words. It's not just your individual right to defend yourself personally or your members of your family against some criminal coming after you. It's your duty to perform this higher level function for your local community, your state, ultimately your national governmental system. And we don't have those institutions, so it's very difficult for people to push back, as it were, against tyrants who have insinuated themselves in one way or another in their state or federal governmental apparatus.
Mm-hmm. So the federal government is claiming now not only authority but the power to do it. And Governor Nordstrom, he's been looking at what's going on around there. He sees these sanctuary cities for marijuana, sanctuary cities for illegal immigration. He says, well, why not guns? And by the way, folks, I don't want you to ever forget this, that if there's a sanctuary city in San Francisco and they allow undocumented citizens, whatever they want to call them, illegal aliens to come across the border and vote, it damages you in Ohio. It damages you in Massachusetts. That is a national election. So that has consequences, see? And because this thing has been so muddied, the authority and the power, and who gets to do this, to think we can allow illegal immigrants to come in, but we can't outlaw abortion state by state? Are you kidding me? What's your response to that, Dr. Vieira? And then I'll let some other guys jump in here.
Well, it's, in a way, it's a kind of a political psychosis, if you will, schizophrenic system that we have. It's exactly that. We can't stop illegal aliens from entering the country, although you can't have a country if you can't control its borders. And yet, on the other hand, apparently you can't stop the mass murder of unborn human beings. Finally, now we're discovering, well, all the people are going to be disarmed. The people who form the institutions which the Constitution tells us are absolutely necessary to maintain this free state concept, these people are now going to be disarmed by this political clique that somehow managed to get control of the apparatus of government. So it's kind of a crazy world we live in, but you come back to some fundamentals. If the people are not going to assert their authority because they have been stripped of their power, it will lead necessarily to a tyrannical system being imposed upon them.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
it. I mean, you go back to the ancient Greek city-states, for instance. I mean, the Founding Fathers were masters of history, and they saw this all the way back from the ancient times, the Greeks and the Romans and so forth and so on, to modern times. That's why you have many of the principles built into the Constitution that, of course, is not taught today, so very many people don't realize these connections. They're there for a reason. This is not something that was put in on a spur of the moment by those people because they had nothing better with which to fill the pages of parchment that they had in front of them. They set up a system based upon a tremendous amount of understanding of history, political history in particular, and the political, what we would call political science, and the understanding of how politics works and social structures work, political power works. And they gave us this. Now, I always look at it as a building with a number of foundations, foundational stones, and they're all necessary to hold the building up. Right? If you take one of them out, you begin to weaken the structure, and the more of them you remove, eventually the structure collapses.
Doctor?
Yes?
Can we ask a few questions along the
way?
Or do you want us to hold towards the end?
Sure.
Well, I've got a couple questions. First of all, are these laws enforceable? I mean, we hear a lot of the bantering, but are they enforceable if they are passed? And if they are enforceable, wouldn't the federal government with a pro-Second Amendment president be able to step in and stop it with its own force?
Let me answer both of those questions because I was going to talk about those two points. Are they enforceable? Well, of course, it depends what the statute says. If the statute says that firearms of a certain type are no longer going to be allowed to be legally sold or imported into the state, they are probably to a certain extent enforceable because under the law as it now stands, the vast majority of firearms are sold through licensed dealers, federally licensed firearms dealers. So if the law of the state simply said, well, we're not going to allow these firearms to be imported or sold, that would be enforceable because they know who these dealers are. And the dealers are subject to regulation and scrutiny both at the federal level and the state level. And all firearms that are sold through the dealers, forms have to be filled out, state and federal forms, so there's a way for them to control that neck of the funnel. If, on the other hand, they're talking about dispossessing people of firearms they already own, so they pass a law that says assault firearms, however they define that, are no longer allowable for possession, not simply in the future, but the ones you have. You have to turn them in or destroy them or sell them out of the state or whatever. That on its face is probably not immediately enforceable because they don't know who has these firearms. There are no general registries that would enable them to identify individuals who possess the prohibited firearms. I know they might find out if people went to shooting ranges or whatever, you know, they could be discovered in that manner, but that would be adventitious. And then if they talk about registration, it's the same situation. They passed gun control statutes in, let's take Connecticut and New York as a classic example, because these were actually held by the courts, that required registration of what they called assault firearms. And they estimated that some number of thousands of these firearms were in private possession throughout the states. And it turned out that a very small number of people complied with the registration requirement. And subsequently, there has been no major move in either Connecticut or New York to hunt down the individuals who possess these firearms and have not registered them. So I think they recognize that that's a very difficult thing to do. Exactly how do you get a warrant on probable cause to search a person's home to find an unregistered firearm? I mean, where do you get the information that would enable you to go before a magistrate or a judge and obtain such a warrant? It's a difficult, practical problem. Now, if you talk about the potential intervention coming out of Washington, D.C., because the President of the United States, Mr. Trump, has made his campaign and afterwards some pretty strong statements about his being in favor of the Second Amendment. I think that's exactly what ought to happen here in Virginia. What we have here is an attack, at least the statutes that I've been looking at, these pre-filed statutes. One of them says that they're going to outlaw all so-called assault firearms. Well, firearms as described in that statute fit exactly the definition of firearms that the United States Supreme Court 1939 upheld in the United States versus Miller case as being protected by the Second Amendment. and protected by the Second Amendment because those firearms could be used for militia purposes for the common defense, all right? That's probably the most important firearms Second Amendment case ever decided by the Supreme Court. Well, all right, the attempt is being made to dispossess people of the firearm necessary for their performance of militia functions. Who's the commander-in-chief of the militia? It's the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So he could directly intervene. I can even tell you the statute, Title 10 of the United States Code, Section 253. He could directly intervene right now, looking at what they're proposing, and simply give an order through a proclamation to the members of the militia of the Commonwealth of Virginia, do not comply with these statutes. And one of those persons, by the way, would be Mr. Northam. He's the direct subordinate of the President of the United States in the militia structure in this country. And he could be told, you will not attempt to enforce these statutes.
Mm.
Oh, it's very, if I were the President of the United States, there would be no problem here. I would write the proclamation. I've already written the proclamation, actually. I'm just trying to figure out a way to get it to him. I would write the proclamation, and I'd deliver it, have it personally delivered to Northam and say, here it is.
Cease and desist, huh? Stop it.
Yeah, well, stop it. That's an order. Right? You're interfering with my ability as President of the United States to call forth the militia. Congress has given me certain authority to call forth the militia under certain circumstances. And if they were called forth under the kinds of circumstances these statutes foresee, such as suppressing insurrections, repelling invasions, executing the laws of the United States, I would need to have these people at least be capable of coming forth with arms that would be satisfactory to perform these kinds of functions. Mm-hmm. Right now, they obtain their arms individually through the free market. That's the way Congress has left it. You people in Virginia government, are going to attempt to cut that off and therefore deprive me, the President of the United States, of the ability to perform my constitutional and statutory functions as commander-in-chief of the militia. And you can't do that. We have a thing called the Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution, which makes the Constitution and laws of the United States supreme over the laws, judicial decisions, executive orders, whatever, of the states. That's built into the federal system. And this militia structure is part of that supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
So let me jump in here real quick, Dr. Vieira. Let's say that whatever. Let's say there was an EMP strike. Let's say whatever, there was some type of, some bomb went off someplace or whatever, and our communication systems are broken down. They don't function. We can't communicate with Washington, D.C. And I live out here in the cornfields and outside of Columbus, Ohio, and I don't have any communication, and I have nobody that really understands. Is anybody out there? Help? Anybody with me? Hey, is there anybody? The purpose of the militia was for, in a situation like that, if that were to happen, Dr. Vieira, that the local people would come together to protect and defend those who live in their area. That would be the original purpose of the militia, right? So if everything, all communication goes down and we're sitting here and we're waiting on the federal government to come and protect us, we're in a world of hurt. Would you agree?
Well, that's absolutely correct, because if you go back to that time, they had methods of communication, which we would still have, I suppose, if all of our electricity were cut off and our internet and phones and so forth. We'd still be able to communicate by, as it were, post, right? People delivering, physically delivering information on paper from one location to another. That was the situation that existed at the time of the Constitution's ratification. And they understood perfectly well that you have emergencies in a locality, and who is going to deal with those initially? Well, it's the victims of that emergency. If they're not organized in some way, they're going to have a very difficult time in responding to whatever the crisis may be. They can't depend upon people from the outside necessarily getting to it. Certainly in those days, they couldn't depend upon people from the outside getting to it. They certainly could never have depended upon any form of central government in, well, initially it was Philadelphia, then Washington, D.C., when they finally set up the Capitol, in coming to the outlying areas in New Hampshire or in Georgia or wherever they might be to provide security. And, of course, today, even with the highly centralized structure we have on paper, if you look at the emergency management operation, FEMA is a relatively small group, and it admits It was only a few months ago, maybe a year ago. Now, FEMA admitted, well, if there were a real emergency, you know, after 3 days, you folks in the localities are on your own. FEMA's not going to be able to get to all of you.
That's right.
Right? We know that. And the problem is that in the face of that, which has been known for a long time, we didn't discover it yesterday, in the face of that, there has been no movement in the direction of revitalizing, that's the word I like to use, revitalizing the militia structures. People are still sitting on their hands, assuming, I guess, that when worse comes to worse, someone will save them from outside of their own localities, at the state level or at the national level. Somebody will come in and save them, which, of course, is not necessarily true. If you have this, take the EMP situation that knocks out the electric grid, and so all communications are gone, certainly outlying states are not going to be helping Ohio. California is not going to be contributing aid to Ohio, or Florida is not going to be contributing aid to Ohio, and the national government will certainly not have enough resources to be able to deal with this on a national level. I mean, the thing, you look at this and it's ridiculous. But what's interesting here is that all of this may tie together in what's going on in Virginia. Because you're mobilizing, they're mobilizing a huge number of people who are looking at this problem solely from the perspective of the individual gun owner, right? They don't want their particular firearms to be taken away, primarily because they're interested in personal protection as opposed to, you know, hunting or target shooting. But the next step in the argument is going to have to be that this is not simply a problem that's directed or a threat that's directed at an individual. It's a threat that's directed at the entire community. All mm-hmm. of these sanctuary Second Amendment resolutions that have gone on have been done at a community level. They've all been done by boards of supervisors, town councils, whatever they are, the local governmental bodies. It hasn't been some kind of petition that's been signed by individuals. Individuals have been behind this. They have been huge rallies in these various localities. I mean, I was in Warren County when our Board of Supervisors passed this. Had probably over 1,000 people in the auditorium of a brand-new high school there.
The new step is not just for the sanctuary cities to stand up and say, that doesn't apply here, but to go to the next step to begin to organize the militia in those local jurisdictions. That has to be the next step. Would you agree?
Well, that's what they're already talking about. Now, one has to be careful that that's done in a constitutional manner, all right? We don't want some kind of what I would call anarchistic organization. And so there are certain limitations and requirements. You have to go back and understand what these structures are and how they're supposed to be organized. And ultimately, they're organized under a state statute. That's been the history, well, back to the colonial period, when they organized under the charters of the various colonies, organized under the acts, ordinances, or whatever that were coming out of the colonial assemblies. So there's a lot of history here that tells you how it has to be done. And the point is that, Virginia being a classic example, we have a statutory structure. All states, I think, have some kind of statutory structure, but they're not implementing it correctly, or it needs some updating in order to fit it into the actualities of the problems that we would to which a militia would be directed. And that's what really people have to do. Beyond telling Governor Northam that he can't sign and the General Assembly can't enact certain kinds of gun control measures, we want those people in Richmond to recognize that they have to take certain steps to revitalize these institutions. In Virginia, the single institution, the militia of the Commonwealth of Virginia. That's the next step. Now, I can tell you one thing. As much as they don't want to shy away from their gun control agenda, those people in Richmond definitely do not want to see the militia of the Commonwealth of Virginia revitalized.
But they don't.
talking to them about that is like showing a cross to a vampire. All right, they recoil in terror from the cross or from garlic or whatever, you know, the problem with the vampire Dracula. All right,
let me open it up here and see if some of our crew here has a question for you. Somebody come on in.
Yeah, I do have a question. My question is, do these people in power understand what's going to happen if they actually implemented these so-called laws with the National Guard, the police, the reaction of the people across the countryside? Do they have any inkling, or are they in just so complete denial that they can't comprehend the resistance that's going to take place?
Good job. Let me follow up on that, Bobby. Dr. Vieira, is it part of their plan to turn the people against the government? Is that part of their plan?
Well, we use this ambiguous term, unfortunately, government. When those people, and I don't care if Richmond, any state capital, when those political figures take unconstitutional actions, they are no longer acting as government.
Mm.
Government is a legal fiction, in a sense. It consists of all of the actions of people in political office that are consistent with the Constitution and constitutional laws of the jurisdiction, whether it's the locality, the state, or the national government in Washington, D.C. When they step one angstrom unit outside of that line, what they're doing is not governmental. It's probably a civil wrong or maybe criminal activity.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And we have statutes that say that. This is clear. It's been clear for a very long time. The Supreme Court has ruled on this. We have statutes. Civil liability, 42 United States Code, Section 1983. Someone acting under color of law violates the civil rights of an individual. He is liable to damages, monetary damages.
Wow.
18 U.S.C. Section 241, 242. If someone violates the civil rights of an individual under color of law, he may be subject to criminal prosecution. Well, who acts under color of law? It's people in public office are the ones who act under color of law. So these statutes are telling you that when people in public office violate your civil rights, constitutional rights, they can be subject to civil penalties or criminal prosecution. They are no longer acting as governmental officials.
Mm.
Now, what are these people in Washington, what I would call these usurpers and aspiring tyrants in Richmond, there's plenty of them in Washington as well, but in Richmond, what do they think will happen? I don't think that they have thought it through. I think that they just assumed with the euphoria of the moment, oh, we've won the election, now we can do anything we want. Let's start passing gun control, because Bloomberg told us to have passed gun control. That was the condition where we were going to get our money. Right? Let's start passing gun control. And then all of a sudden, they poked the sleeping giant, awakened and said, to quote Nancy Reagan, no. Just say no, right? That was Nancy Reagan, drugs and alcohol, just say no. Just say no to gun control. And took this kind of action, which was really unprecedented in terms of the extent of it and how fast it occurred, took this action in the direction of the sanctuary jurisdiction, Second Amendment sanctuary movement. And once again, all through the local governmental bodies, not as simply as a matter of people yelling and screaming politically and maybe signing petitions or, you know, marching or whatever as individuals. They went to the local governmental bodies and said, we need this kind of resolution passed. And the local bodies responded to a vast majority in the state, said yes. I don't think those people in Richmond had any idea this was going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Hey, Dom,
I have a question.
Dom, don't you believe that the evidence that Donald Trump has appointed more constitutional judges than any presidents in history is a point to what is coming, and he sees it down the road, maybe?
Well, you know, when you talk about constitutional judges, I always say wait and see.
Right.
Right. Let's see, when they get a particular case in front of them and when they're making deals in the back room, one judge or one justice with another, you vote for me on this case, I'll vote for you on that case. And they do that. Oh, absolutely they do that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens. All right. Now, in Virginia, unfortunately, we are subject to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. That covers Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, and the Carolinas. And a few years ago, they had a gun control statute, not quite as extreme as the ones that are being proposed now in Virginia, but, you know, of the typical New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, California variety, coming out of Maryland. And they upheld it in an en banc opinion. They had 14 judges ruling on it. and 10 of them said, oh, this is perfectly constitutional, doesn't violate the Second Amendment, and 4 of them dissented. So as far as Virginia is concerned right now, judicially speaking, we're behind the eight ball, because any case that is brought in the federal courts, U.S. District Courts, we have two of them, Eastern District and Western District of Virginia, either one of those courts, of course, will follow the earlier ruling of the Fourth Circuit, the Court of Appeals, and then one can expect that the Court of Appeals, being split in that decision 10-4, is not going to change its opinion with respect to a Virginia statute that parallels the type of statute that was enacted in Maryland. So that leaves you with the Supreme Court of the United States, where you say, okay, President Trump has apparently gotten a majority of conservatives on the Supreme Court, and maybe when Justice Ginsburg leaves, there'll be another one. Well, maybe. But the problem was that case that came out of Virginia, the Colby versus Hogan case, which was an extreme case, because it literally turned upside down the Supreme Court's ruling in District of Columbia versus Heller, the more recent decision in favor of the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court refused to hear it. The people filed a petition for a writ of certiorari, and the Supreme Court denied it. Now, that doesn't mean that the Supreme Court necessarily agreed with what the Fourth Circuit had done. They denied petitions for certiorari in 90%, 95% of the cases. I mean, their workload is so high that they can't hear but a very small percentage of the cases that are brought to them. So a denial of certiorari doesn't mean they agreed. It just means they didn't want to hear it for whatever reason. But there's your difficulty. You could imagine some of these statutes being passed in Virginia. It goes all the way to the Fourth Circuit. I mean, you're talking a couple of years, goes through the Fourth Circuit, gets to the Supreme Court, and for one reason or another, they don't hear it. Well, too bad for you, Virginians. You're now stuck with this thing, right? And I think the same thing would be true in the state courts, because I would imagine that the state judges, at least on a Second Amendment issue, which is the federal issue, they would look to what are the federal courts doing in this jurisdiction, or what have the federal courts done in this jurisdiction. And they'd pretty much simply rubber stamp a statute on the basis that, well, the Fourth Circuit's already ruled on this and said this kind of a statute is not unconstitutional. So judicially speaking, notwithstanding what Mr. Trump has done in various places in the country, he hasn't cleaned up the Fourth Circuit by any stretch of the imagination. And as far as I know, he hasn't cleaned up the U.S. District Courts in Virginia in particular. And thirdly, you never know about these people. I mean, Souter was appointed by whom? Was that Reagan or Ford? I can't remember. He was supposed to be a constitutional man, came out of New Hampshire. He turned out to be a liberal. Sandra Day O'Connor, there was another one. Like Kennedy. Of course, Kennedy flipped back and forth. Sometimes he was liberal, sometimes he was conservative. Robert. But he was a loose cannon. You couldn't tell.
Roberts. Somebody else, come on in.
I got a question. When it comes down to the way I see it, white elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about, what are the police going to do? Are they going to attempt to enforce it? That's what the rubber's going to meet the road.
What's the power?
There's your question. Because that comes back to, well, how are you going to enforce it? And then if you can figure a way to enforce it, who's going to do the enforcing? All right?
That's the question.
So here in Virginia, we have sheriffs in every county. That's a constitutional office. You have to have it. And then some counties have their own county police forces as well, depending on local option.
State police.
And the towns and the cities also have your local police. So
then you have state police right under the governor.
And then you have the state police, which is a much smaller operation. So you have all of those. And then, of course, the National Guard. And you're already hearing from various sheriffs who have said, well, we're not going to enforce any of these Second Amendment violations. We're not going to be a party to that.
Come back to
I would
sheriffs,
imagine the local police in where I live, Warren County, we have a sheriff's department, and then the town of Front Royal, a small town, has its own municipal police small operation. And the sheriff here, newly elected sheriff, said, well, he's not going to violate the Second Amendment rights of any of the citizens. And I imagine that I haven't heard yet, but I imagine that the city police are going to say the same thing. So you have a lot of people who will just stand down And if it's a matter of investigation, all those investigations will just drag on forever, and they'll never be settled. We'll never know which way or who has the guns or whatever. Then the National Guard have already heard from people, individuals, who say, well, the attitude of the National Guard is entirely negative to this. And by the way, as I said earlier, who is the commander-in-chief of the National Guard? National Guard is called part of the militia of Commonwealth of Virginia, all right? One of the components of the militia. Who's the commander-in-chief of the National Guard? This same thing happened under Eisenhower and then under Kennedy in the segregation battles that went on in the 50s and the early 60s. Eisenhower was involved with Orville Forbes, so I think it was the governor of Arkansas, and Forbes was threatening, or maybe he had done it, to call out the National Guard of Arkansas to prevent integration. I think it was integration, maybe universities, whatever. And Eisenhower just stepped in and took control of the National Guard away from Forbes. Same thing was threatened in Alabama with George Wallace. Wallace eventually made a deal with Lyndon Johnson when Johnson became president. But the National Guard is not some tool of Mr. Northam that he can use without consequences. If, and there's the if President Trump decides to exercise his authority. So we talk about judges. Yeah, there are judges, but it gets the judges, it's years and years worth of litigation. It's much quicker process dealing with this coming out of the White House, and there's the real question in my mind. Right, looking at this thing going on, if it becomes a really serious conflict in Virginia, and they do pass some of this very extreme legislation, and Northam decides, I'm going to enforce this no matter what. Right? And he starts using the National Guard or sending directives to the local police or sheriffs. What will Mr. Trump do? I'll tell you what I would do. I mean, there's no question. I told you before. It's really simple. I would do the same thing Eisenhower. And I would use Eisenhower's example. That's what I would tell Northam. I said, you're doing something which is just as bad as what those Southerners were trying to do in the maintenance of segregation when it had been determined that that was unconstitutional. And you're threatening to use the National Guard to uphold this unconstitutional system. And I, as President of the United States, am going to stop you. I simply have superior authority. I have not only superior power, but I have superior authority.
Amen. So, Dr. V.
I will use them. I think this will very quickly, if it's done correctly, will drop the ball, or send the ball, however you want, whatever metaphor you want to use, will put the ball in Mr. Trump's court.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot depend upon, you're not going to be, in Virginia, you're not going to be able to depend upon any arm of the state government. Legislature's against you, executive branch is against you, judiciary is probably against you, and judiciary action takes years. You're certainly not going to be able to depend upon the federal courts, because as I said, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which controls this jurisdiction, is adamantly in favor of gun control. Right? Well, who is left? Well, the local jurisdictions are stepping up, but the local jurisdictions are always subject in one way or another to direct or indirect pressure coming out of the state government in Richmond. So within our federal system, if the local jurisdictions cannot look to the state government, where will they look? Well, to the federal government, right? We have a federal system whereby the federal government can intervene under the Supremacy Clause. Who's the person who has the direct authority in this particular instance? Oh, it's the President of the United States.
So
that's why I say he's going to be in trouble, because he's not going to be able to fob this off on somebody else. He's not going to be able to shrug his shoulders and say, oh, well, let the courts deal with this, 5 years from now. All right? And you think about a situation where you might have a confiscation of firearms. And let's just assume that the people rolled over and said, okay, we'll turn over our guns. So all the tens of thousands of guns are turned over. What happens to those guns? Well, they'll be destroyed. Right?
Yeah.
So 5 years from now, when the Supreme Court finally rules, oh, that confiscation was unconstitutional, the guns are gone.
Mm.
Right? The Democrats have achieved their goal of dispossessing the people of these guns. And what are they going to do? Pay them 10 cents on the dollar for the value of the guns they've taken? If somebody has a receipt that will show how much that gun was cost when he purchased it. Think of the complications of this. So to solve the problem, if I were the president of the United States, I'd say I'd just write a proclamation saying, here it is. I have this authority. You're interfering with it. End of discussion. And I'm giving you these peremptory orders. Oh, and by the way, the Supreme Court has ruled on these particular, this particular statute I'm talking about. The Supreme Court ruled way back in the turn of the 19th century. They said, well, when the president is exercising this authority over the militia, the judiciary and the state authorities have no say mm-hmm. in what he does.
Dr. Vieira, so we got about 5 minutes left here, Dr. Vieira. What do or should we do? We're all here. Our eyes are open. We're awake. We see what's going on. While we're waiting for all this to be playing out, what should we be doing now?
Well, number one, you can't let the same thing happen in your state that happened in Virginia, where Bloomberg money comes in and controls key races so that the gun control fanatics can gain power in the state legislature and the state executive branch. That's number one. Don't allow the scenario to play out. Then number two, essentially the same thing that Virginia has done, if it turns out that radical gun control legislation is threatened or is coming out of your state legislature, then you need to mobilize the local governmental bodies. It's not enough to, as I say, to have individual petitions. And then number three, people have to start thinking about how do we get to President Trump and lay this problem at his feet, the steps of the White House? Because he's your last hope. I mean, Congress is not going to do anything about this. They're tied mm-hmm. up in impeachment and all this other nonsense. Certainly the House is, and the Senate will be shortly. So you can't expect to get some new legislation out of Congress. The Democrats will simply stop it in the House of Representatives. And as far as the federal courts are concerned, depending on where you are, maybe you have a sympathetic federal judiciary at the lower level. Well, what if you don't? And even if you do, you're talking about several years worth of litigation in any one of these cases, because they'll go on through the district court and the appeals court, and whoever wins or loses will try to take it to the Supreme Court of the United States. So that's a very long and involved process. So if one wants to be prepared for the immediate problem, the answer is politically at the state level, legally and politically at the local level, and then let's put Mr. Trump's feet to the fire. He promised and has kept promising since the election, since the campaign, I should say, to support the Second Amendment. Here we have a direct attack on the Second Amendment. It could not be clearer than this. All right. What's he going to do?
Do we need to organize? Do we need to reorganize the local militias, Dr. Vieira? Is that something we can begin to do?
Well, you need to start talking to the local jurisdictions to put pressure on the state government. Because, as I said, in every state, I don't know the exact terms of the statute in Ohio, but in every state, there is a provision in your state statutes already, and maybe in your constitution also, for a constitutional militia. And as far as I know, none of them gives that authority, delegates that authority directly to a local jurisdiction, all right, to do it on its own. I mean, the local jurisdictions participate in the state structure. And so what the local jurisdictions have to do is, number one, they have to be talking to the people in the state capital. Number two, there's no reason that the local jurisdictions can't take various kinds of preparatory action, as long as they don't call it militia, as long as they don't do something that's outside of the plain terms of the state statute. And that, I mean, I could talk to you for hours about that, the possibilities of doing that. It depends upon what your state law is. And we're already thinking, I mean, people are already thinking about that in Virginia.
Right. We're calling brigades. We're thinking about it everywhere we go. The opportunity, folks, listen, always remember this, that the most effective government is the government closest to you. You can have the greatest impact. If we have our eyes focused on national politics, we are going to suffer locally. So you need to begin, as I say over and over and over, build your downline. Find people who are like-minded in your area and begin to get together with them. And Dr. Vieira said, don't call them a militia. Call them whatever. Call them brigades. Call them huddles. Call them whatever you want to. But it's imperative that we, the people, begin to get together to imagine what happens if government goes away, whatever that would be, whatever that, however that would happen, if government went away, if things got so bad that you couldn't count on your state cops, you imagine how overboard your sheriff, your local sheriff, how burdened they would be. They wouldn't have enough officers. We've got to be smart enough, folks, to prepare for those kind of times coming. Imagine a huge blizzard, a tornado, whatever. Are you prepared? Are we prepared to come together locally to make a difference? That's really ultimately what we're talking about. Dr. Vieira, thanks for giving us some time. We'll have you on again. We didn't even get into the money. We didn't even get into some of these other issues. And you're a wealth of knowledge, and God bless you for giving us
well, your thank time. You for the opportunity, Dave.
We'll do it again. God bless you, folks. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday morning.